Censorship is something that the West has long criticized China for. But now, it is no longer just a Chinese problem. It's a global one. Internet blackouts, social media shutdowns, and banned withdrawing by governments cost the global economy $5.5 billion in 2021. And not only that, but internet shutdowns are dangerous, as with it comes censorship, information regulation, and isolation from the outside world. I'm Christy Ai, and you're watching The Cost of Everything, where today we're going to be looking at the dangers of internet censorship and what it costs the economy when the internet gets shut down and the citizens are disconnected. Now, according to one study, the economic cost of government-enforced internet shutdowns grew 36% last year compared to 2020. Estimates of almost 500 million people were affected by these internet blackouts. Now, in 2021, there were 182 documented cases of internet shutdowns across 34 different countries. And in Africa, government-directed internet shutdowns have threatened digital penetration and growth. Myanmar's economy was the most severely impacted by internet shutdowns in 2021 following the military coup. This was followed by the extensive internet and social media shutdowns as local journalists reported that they have been logged off of platforms such as Telegram and Signal. Coup leaders have imposed a near total internet shutdown and have introduced a draft cybersecurity law that would impose draconian rule and allow the government access to user data. As a result, Myanmar took a hit of $2.8 billion. Now, Ethiopia's northern Tigray region has been in a nearly two-year internet and phone shutdown after Prime Minister Abiy ordered a military offensive on the breakaway region in November of 2020. Abiy's government now holds the record for the second longest internet shutdown in the world. This is estimated to have a cost of over $165 million. When internet access is restricted in Africa, everyone who is part of the fast-growing internet economy, including online vendors who sell items on Instagram, banks that rely on the internet to facilitate payments, personal communication, media access, etc., everyone is affected. Almost all internet shutdowns in Africa for the last 5 years have been because of political protests. A study showed that these shutdowns occur during times of political contestation, such as elections, rising fuel prices in the country, and protests. Nigeria was also heavily impacted after it blocked access to Twitter in June of 2021. And the estimated economic loss is around $1.5 billion. So what happens when governments cut the internet in their countries? The economic cost of internet shutdowns around the globe equated to about $5.5 billion in 2021, and this includes over 30,000 hours of government internet disruptions. Twitter was the most blocked social media platform with over 12,000 hours of disruption, which is 60% more than Facebook. And for more, let's bring in Dr. Winston Mano, author and University of Winston professor. So, Professor, it seems like all these shutdowns occur during times of political unrest. But does shutting down off access to communication and the internet a good strategy to quell unrest, or does it actually promote further dissatisfaction?
I think it's the wrong move by African governments and also other governments in the world to think that they can just shut down the internet and especially block social media applications that people that are popular with members of the public. I think before internet, people used to have, you know, other alternative ways of circulating information. So when there is that internet shutdown, it doesn't mean they close off communication channels. It just means other channels kick in. For example, people will still be able to phone each other. People will still be able to circulate, you know, information. We have what we call the pavement radio in Africa, the rumor mill, where the word of mouth can spread rapidly. People can carry words and news and spread it. And to have such things, it's wrong in terms of election or when you have a pandemic like COVID. It means sometimes the information that is circulating is unverified. It's actually can be very dangerous, can lead to protests, can lead to more dangerous environment. So in my view, shutting down is not the answer. Keeping them open, but managing them and making sure the government promotes its own point of view alongside other perspectives is much more fruitful. This should be the way to go.
And are there ways to bypass internet shutdowns that are well known for citizens in these countries?
Yes, yes, there are. Like VPNs, people deploy them. They jump, you know, the walls that are, you know, the walled gardens that that are put in. And even when the restrictions are, like in Uganda, for example, they introduced an extra, you know, charge on using WhatsApp. And this was not productive. I mean, when people are already using this, they can still share whatever comes through using other media rather than just WhatsApp. There are so many applications. So for politicians to target specific applications and shut them down, it doesn't augur well. But I also want to say, you know, this is why it's important to advocate net neutrality, so that there is the content there cannot be controlled. Yeah? The content should be, you know, available freely, should be also multifaceted. And people must have options rather than limitations when they are using the internet.
And how are businesses affected during these internet shutdowns? Not just the local businesses, but the platforms like Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. Are the shutdowns a big hit to their bottom lines as well?
Yes, to some extent. There is quite a lot of business that they get from using the internet. Like, for example, when they are reaching national customers or international customers, in this day and age, Africa has, you know, opportunity to trade with not only people within Africa, but outside. And when the internet is down, some people use the internet, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Google as, you know, their other offices. Yeah? And when there is no business coming through, say, the local eBay equivalent, then it means that their intake for the day will be limited. So how do they negotiate these things? They normally would subscribe to more than one platform. They would try to maximize, they have a presence in different platforms. It's a strategy that is very old, where even for telecommunications, most businesses, they own telephone lines that are run by different telecommunications companies. If one telecommunication company is not viable, then they go to another. And this has been a strategy that works, yeah.
Now, India had a massive internet blackout in 2020 that cost the country an estimated $2.8 billion loss and $4 billion in global losses. Why were the internet curbs in India higher than any other country?
In India, they are very keen in recreating internet in ways that work for them. I think they are taking a leaf from China, which is using, you know, local apps and using internet in order to leverage their own business operations. So in India, for example, when they had in 2016 a ban on Facebook, they were very keen on protecting net neutrality so that their applications that they would rely on and internet shutdowns sometimes implemented for political reasons, like when there's political protests, which are triggered by information on the internet. But like I said, the strategy of closing down for me does not work. You end up, you know, penalizing even business wanting to deal with a political situation. So it needs policy environments that are much more responsive to the needs, and it needs a stakeholder kind of, you know, approach where you talk to business especially, but also to civil society and work out solutions that agree with everyone. It's not just about what the government wants or what the political party in charge, and this can be wrong, yeah.
Dr. Winston Mano, thank you so much. Dr. Winston will be joining us again after the break when we discuss how the internet's most basic function of communication is used as a control and censorship tool in Africa, since they're vastly dependent on just one tech giant. We'll have more after the break.
Russia in the 21st century has taken several opportunities to try to see if there would be interest in the West to create new boundaries, to create a new relationship. And as you mentioned, time and time and time again, it would get flatly rejected because we have sort of pushed Russia into this corner, ideologically, attitudinally, to say, you're the adversary, we may not be in a formal bipolar ideological Cold War anymore, but we're not going to allow a new relationship to develop with you.
Welcome back. While most of us think about the internet as a valuable news outlet and a place to consume entertainment, one of the most basic functions of the internet is actually communication. Meta-owned messaging app WhatsApp is extremely popular internationally as it operates on a Wi-Fi connection for free. African nations, Argentina, Malaysia, Colombia, and Brazil have some of the highest WhatsApp user rates. And more than 90% of internet users are on WhatsApp. In these countries, WhatsApp is basically the portal into the internet. WhatsApp allows people to communicate and chat with friends, receive news updates and media coverage, as well as set up a merchant commerce account to operate a small business and receive payments. So when there is a communication blackout on WhatsApp, there's confusion and panic as citizens are suddenly unable to communicate with friends and family. And while we think of censorship as a power move that is often associated with political regimes trying to control the media, censorship at a basic level halts communication between people in a country. And because the internet in Africa is basically Meta, it is centralized and becomes very easy for those in power to enforce these shutdowns. So how exactly do these shutdowns work? Well, one way is for the authorities to issue a notice to the individual service providers, in this case Meta, to carry out their will. This is known as URL-based blocking, which is a filter that prevents access to a list of banned sites. Users trying to access these sites might see that the server was not found. Another method is called throttling, where it severely limits traffic to specific sites, giving the impression that the service is slow, thereby discouraging access. It is more subtle because it is difficult to know whether these sites are being actively restricted or whether poor broadband infrastructure is to blame. And as a final measure, telecom companies can be required to shut down their services entirely, preventing all access. And because internet service providers like Meta are licensed by governments, they risk fines or the loss of their contracts if they do not comply. And for more, let's bring back Dr. Winston Mano, author and professor of the University of Westminster. So Facebook is not just an online social network. It is a big owner of the internet infrastructure in Africa. So just how plugged in is Facebook to the daily lives of the people in Africa?
Some of these businesses, they enter markets like Africa without clearly declaring their interest to, you know, to do business, without telling the Africans that, look, we are here not to, you know, we are here to look after our own business, but we are also here to try to promote your own business. So many Africans, they feel that Facebook, when it enters Africa, it is actually an investor which is coming to provide employment, which is coming to provide solutions. But the solutions, one must understand, these solutions are obviously initially meant for themselves. They are solutions that will promote the Facebook brand rather than. So when Facebook was banned in India, one asked the question, why was Facebook, the same free basics program, why was it accepted in Africa? Why has it gone on to be common in more than, you know, 30 African countries? There is something wrong, you know, because people have poor explanation or understanding of that argument that was used by the Indians. In Africa, it has grown without much hassle. Part of this is that Facebook has since learned from its mistakes in India. In Africa, they have proceeded quietly, according to research. They have, for example, partnered civil society, and they have amplified their fight against, you know, censorship, against shutdowns. And so the discourse is not necessarily what Facebook is doing. It's about something else. So it's about, you know, government behavior. It's about the internet shutdowns. I'm not saying they should not be focused on that, but Facebook has used the kind of, you know, issues in the African environment to mask some of its strategies. It should declare its strategy. It should be much more forthcoming so that it's a win-win intervention in Africa.
Now, Kenya wants to ban Facebook over hate speech, raising fears of censorship. But what will life in Kenya be like without Facebook?
I think when Kenyan officials are saying that, they are saying, look, let's talk. These are issues that are really important. Yeah. You saw that even in Nigeria, banning Twitter and, you know, saying the issue is a new relational accountability whereby, you know, these tech giants, they need to just stop thinking of themselves as technology companies. They also have a lot of media, you know, a lot of communicative ability, which is affecting ordinary life. We all know about, you know, the Cambridge Analytica problem. We all know how Facebook is now implicated in its algorithms are now, you know, influencing the way make decisions in elections. They can highlight certain content at the expense of other content. And what we are saying is that there is need for Facebook to actually listen. I have seen some videos where Mark Zuckerberg is sometimes brought to the Congress to answer certain questions. We don't have this policy power within Africa. In most African countries, there's a lot of trust that these tech companies, they are coming in good faith. But that good faith is not rewarded. So when Kenya is saying, look, we don't like, you know, the projection of hate speech on Facebook, they are looking for action. They are looking for a response from Facebook where Facebook does something positive about tackling the hate speech. They need to work with locals in order to identify the sources of hate speech. And if verified, work with local policy players verified this should be taken down rather than promoted, because we know that, you know, Facebook, like all the other tech companies, they benefit from it, from eyes that come to controversial content. Yeah. So they should remove content that makes profit, but it's affecting locals' interests. Yeah.
And WhatsApp is the biggest social media platform in Africa, and it's clear that a lot of people get their news from WhatsApp as well. Is it dangerous when all of this is centralized on one platform so that Meta can basically control all narratives and news sources?
Yes, I think WhatsApp is quite popular. Also increasingly now WeChat is being popular, the Chinese version. But WhatsApp is way, way ahead, you know. And a lot of people, again, in Africa, we use WhatsApp to relay news. A lot of people are publishing newspapers via WhatsApp. Yeah, they curate news stories. They share to large with large groups, but it's also a source of, you know, lies. It's a source of fake news. It's a source of inaccurate information. So WhatsApp is not just, you know, a social media for people saying hello to each other. In Africa, in contexts which are, you know, with scanned information or with underserved by information, social media like WhatsApp become really, you know, important gateways for people. They are expecting quality information. So how do you implement that? At the moment, I think the functions of WhatsApp are very controversial. And in some cases, you have some controls that are being used, like in Zimbabwe. I'll give you an example that came up this week. One woman who teaches was a member belonging to a WhatsApp group, and she complained about salaries and asked other colleagues to join her. And that discussion in a private WhatsApp group ended up with the police, because one of the person mentioned in the group reported her to the police. And the Zimbabwean police officials arrested the woman. So we can see how WhatsApp in environments that don't have, you know, freedom, or that have limited freedom, or where people are struggling with other basic issues, it can assume other dimensions that can undermine, you know, the dreams of internet freedom that, you know, the fathers of ICTs wanted with these technologies. What we have is a continued kind of restrictions that have become known for, you know, for within this context. Yeah, so it's a real problem, I would argue.
Is WhatsApp shaping democracy in Africa? We have a study here that shows that WhatsApp has been both emancipatory as well as destructive during election campaigns.
In my view, in my humble view, it has provided vital information which others want to censor out. But it's also a double-edged sword. Yeah? In a way, it also provides inaccurate information. And in most cases, if users are not savvy, you find that they may end up, you know, aligning with other, you know, blocks. But at the moment, I would argue there's not much, you know, when I go to Zimbabwe, I see my relatives from what are called, you know, rural areas or areas that are not fully served by mass media. They are in the know. They would know what is happening from messages that are circulated on WhatsApp. So WhatsApp has widened the news kind of audience. It is in a way provided, you know, an emancipatory function whereby people have, you know, access to the news. The decisions they make, more research is needed after looking at the news. At the moment, the decision they make, it doesn't necessarily translate to the WhatsApp, say, activism. But in a way, digital activism is taking shape, where presidents used to lie and say things without challenge. I have written about this. Sometimes they go, say, on WhatsApp or Twitter and claim to have done A, B, C, D. People will reply straight away and say, no, you are lying. I live in this area. You did not do this. So it has sort of fostered new kind of politics where leaders need to be much more, you know, accountable, need to be much more straightforward in their relationship with the electorate.
Dr. Winston Mana, thank you so much for your time and insight. Now, there are very few winners in an environment where access to information is restricted. But in these areas, demand for VPN services has skyrocketed as citizens sought to regain access to news and communication. Now, another alternative is, of course, the decentralized Web 3.0. But that is still in its infancy and is not yet able to provide the same ease of access that people are used to. It also does not have enough users and content to match that of the traditional web either. But decentralizing the internet may be a lot harder than many realize. And even crypto is not the perfect solution. Crypto company Labra's CEO is trying to raise awareness among the Ethereum validators running the Flashbot software that they may be unintentionally contributing to censorship within the Ethereum network. According to a survey, approximately 45 to 50% of all ETH blocks currently being validated run MEV Boost Relay Flashbots and comply with the US sanctions. Validators have a financial incentive to use these relays as they're being paid to use it. And these findings were reinforced when another study found that of the 19,400 blocks verified by Flashbot's relay, none of them included a single Tornado Cash transaction. And Tornado Cash, as you recall, was banned by the US Treasury earlier this year. Censorship fears have deepened post-merge, and as the prohibitive cost of becoming a validator could result in a consolidation of validator nodes to bigger crypto firms who are much more susceptible to being influenced by government sanctions. So it is disturbing that in this day and age, where we take our freedom of speech for granted, there is a trend where we find that freedom is slowly getting eroded away from all sides. I'm Christy I. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you right back here next time on The Cost of Everything.